Blog Talk Radio.
From the far reaches of the known universe, we are proud to present Brother Harold Muhammad, soldier, scientist, scholar. Blog Talk Radio's finest. Not so mad science on Black Hole Radio. Black Hole Radio. Black Hole Radio. Black
Hole Radio. Black Hole Radio. Black Hole Radio. Assalamu alaikum. And welcome to tonight's edition of Not So Mad Science here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, and as always, coming to you live from the city of Detroit. Just because Berry Gordy took Motown to L.A. does not mean Detroit has lost its soul. Tonight, as promised, we are going into part three of the program dealing with mental health disorders, extreme and high anxiety, the debilitating effects of these conditions on the heart, the mind, and the spirit. So, we're going to pick up where we left off last week, but I want to insert a greater definition, if you will, and a greater power of belief that anxiety in all its forms can be defeated and cured. To that end, let's take a look and see what we have. There are, let's put it this way, your palms are sweaty, your stomach is extremely upset, can't control it, no matter what you do, you can't settle yourself down, your heart is racing, you feel a knot that has moved up into your upper chest, between your breasts. And it feels like a fist is there and you want to vomit, but you can't vomit. Thoughts of worry, fear, and condemnation flood through your mind. You think you're dying. And for all intents and purposes, you are dying. In the spirit. You are dying. In your soul. So what do you do? Thoughts and worries of death are overwhelming you. Believe me when I tell you, no, you're not dying. You're having the mother of all panic attacks. Sounds very simple, but believe me when I tell you, it's not simple, but it is curable. Anxiety affects approximately 40 million people here in this wilderness called North America. For some, anxiety causes some slight discomfort or distress. For others, it is crippling, debilitating. It causes the afflicted individual to either miss work, become socially withdrawn, avoid places, people, situations entirely, or even lead to being institutionalized for a period of time because you cannot deal with the environment due to this anxiety. So, if you or a loved one has ever dealt with the irritating, often incapacitating effects of anxiety, I want you to take heart. I want you to find a firm foundation to stand on. there are several very tactical approaches for lessening your stress and decreasing your anxiety. But you first have to know what anxiety is. Similar to fear, anxiety is an emotional response designed to keep us out of danger. However, while fear typically occurs in the presence of an identifiable threat, anxiety more often occurs in the absence of an identifiable threat. Why is that? For those who take medication for allergies, for those who take medication for stomach problems, the medication becomes the source by which your normal ability to handle stressful situations and your emotions. These medications will cause you to lose the capacity to discern reality. It strips you of your cognitive ability to manage yourself. So, in other words, whether it be an organic or chemical issue which creates the anxiety, the anxiety in essence is caused by your thoughts, your worries, and your concerns related to a fear of something, but not the actual existence of whatever it is causing the fear itself. So even though there may be an organic or a chemically induced anxiety, knowing this gives you the tools you need to manage and control it. It is the absence of knowledge that allows these things to overwhelm you. So, when it comes to eliminating stress and anxiety, or at least lessening the effects, the first step is to develop an awareness. Where is your anxiety really coming from? Is it an organic problem? Organic meaning you're having a reaction to something that you ate. You're having a reaction to something in the world environment around you that causes you to lose your cognitive ability? Or is it a chemically induced anxiety caused by medications? You're having an allergic response to your allergy medication. All these things come into play. All these things are part of a greater whole. Knowledge, wisdom, and understanding of where the problem begins gives you the tools to manage that problem. There are three general areas of the brain where anxiety originates: the prefrontal cortex, the hypo or hippocampus, the area of the brain associated with memory, and the amygdala. It is important to recognize which demon circuit of your brain triggers your anxiety so that you can pinpoint the root and effectively go about treating it. If your anxiety has its root in your prefrontal cortex, when the prefrontal cortex is in overdrive, people tend to worry and have trouble letting go of negative thoughts that contribute to the anxiety. In my study, to find the best way, to find the more helpful and curative way, I looked into the research of Dr. Daniel G. Amen and his associates to find the means by which a curative process to remove the demon circuits which allow the anxiety to overwhelm you to be closed and shut off. Although this particular area of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, is associated specifically with rational thoughts, it's important to realize not all of the thoughts are truly rational when it is excited, which creates the anxiety. If your hippocampus is the root of your anxiety. The hippocampus stores memories and emotions. When a situation arises, your brain automatically pulls up the related memories. If your past experiences in similar scenarios were very, very negative, that triggers the anxiety response. If your anxiety has its roots in the amygdala, the amygdala part of your brain is responsible for the physical reactions our bodies produce in the midst of stress or panic, muscle tension, heart palpitations, sweaty palms are all the result of a hyperactive amygdala initiating the panic mode in response to a real or perceived threat. In my study, I researched a book by Dr. Pittman and Dr. Carl, which then gave me insight that not more often than not, at least two, sometimes three, of the areas which allow anxiety, panic, and fear to overwhelm a person, and typically two of these areas are excited, one more than the other, but both are working in concert, which allows the panic attack, the anxiety, to become crippling. However, if your anxiety comes from the thoughts and images flowing through your mind, it is your prefrontal cortex. You can begin to identify the areas of your brain which are overly stimulated by fighting to remain calm and taking a good look at yourself. The prefrontal cortex is that area just above and behind your eyes that needs to be addressed. If strong anxiety reactions appear to be triggered for no apparent reason, your brain may be pulling up negative memories from your past. If, however, there is a real threat happening in the world, your amygdala will trigger a fear response to help you get out of harm's way. But when overly stimulated, it no longer gets you to put things, pull you out of harm's way, but it becomes the thing that harms you the most. For example, if you see a vicious dog on a chain, your amygdala will trigger a fear reaction, causing you to feel anxious. But if you see a non-threatening dog, and your mind begins to visualize or think of the ways it might hurt you, that's your prefrontal cortex reacting to old memories and beliefs. This too will cause your amygdala to overreact. We have to know our bodies in order to know what to do to cure and keep ourselves healthy. While there are many tactics you can use to tackle your anxiety, I'm going to share with you the 8 most effective ways that I believe you can calm your mind, your prefrontal cortex, and reduce the possibility of stimulating your amygdala. The first cause of action I'm going to suggest to you is, and you're going to need help, life is never meant for you to live alone. We all must seek out help. And the best help and the greatest help you can get is the help that is going to be there for life and not the help that you can only pay for. The help. So, number one, cognitive diffusion. Sounds like 2 big words, but it really means something quite simple. Cognitive diffusion. Cognitive fusion occurs when we allow ourselves to believe that our negative thoughts, our worries, or our visions are a reality when in fact they're not. It is important to recognize that just because you think something bad is going to happen, and I'm guilty of this myself, I'm not just speaking to you, talking to myself too. Just because I think something bad is going to happen doesn't mean that it will. You don't have to believe every negative thought that comes your way, because you're being told that you're a sinner and you're sinful doesn't make you a sinner. However, we are born in iniquity, in a nation of sin. Therefore, we have all sinned, but that does not make us guilty of crime. That crime against God? No. It makes us human. Practicing cognitive diffusion means being aware of your thoughts without necessarily believing they are true or thinking they will become a reality, nor the suggestion from others tempting your mind to believe something that is not so. They have an agenda, and their agenda is not necessarily, well, put it this way, their agenda is absolutely not your agenda. Learning to observe negative thoughts or images that enter your mind without feeding into them or getting completely absorbed by them. This is essential to reducing your anxiety. Cognitive diffusion is assisted simply by sitting down, taking a moment of pause, going into prayer or meditation, and then having a conversation with someone who cares enough to listen to you and believe you because you believe what you're saying and have the conversation. It has nothing to do with right or wrong. It has all to do with, do you care enough to listen to me to speak my mind and give me back an honest reaction because I believe something? Show me the alternative without telling me I'm right or wrong. Cognitive diffusion. Sometimes people just want to ventilate and let their mind speak out what they're feeling to release the anxiety. We can talk about what I said at another time, but let me say what I feel. The next thing you want to consider is practice optimism. You'll find people who suffer from anxiety and depression live amongst pessimistic people. They have nothing positive to say. Pessimists are more likely to feel anxious than optimistic because pessimistic thoughts are inherently anxiety-provoking. You can ease your individual anxiety by being more conscientious of your thoughts and making an effort to eliminate ones that make you feel poorly. You don't have to stand there and argue with a fool. Be confident in what you feel. Be confident and strong in how what you feel makes you feel better. And then do the work to manage and hold on to what you feel that makes you feel better. Rather than thinking thoughts such as things never go my way, something's bound to go wrong, or I always disappoint people, replace that thought with more accepting, loving, and optimistic ideas and thoughts in your mind. For instance, just because I think something is going to happen doesn't mean it will. In fact, oftentimes, when you feel something would go wrong, it actually went really well. Why? Because we're only human. Everyone makes mistakes. Everyone can be forgiven for their mistakes. And mistakes at times, and we make mistakes at times, and that's okay to make mistakes. They're there for us to learn from, not to die from, not to be called slut, bitch, whore, dog, prostitute, this, that, or other, some other negative, nasty things. To be told you're worthless or no good. No. We make mistakes. We must grow and evolve from our mistakes. Those kind of statements are much more productive and effective in reducing your anxiety produced in the prefrontal cortex. Number three, cognitive behavioral therapy. This is number three on my list of eight things. Again, three words that sound like three very big words that you don't understand. Well, cognitive behavioral therapy is a form of therapy in which negative thought processes are challenged in order to alter your unwanted emotions or behavior. Cognitive behavioral therapy has been shown to help reduce obsessive negative thoughts and worries associated with anxiety. all these things I've researched in such great detail over these last few weeks, where I don't sleep at night because I'm up studying and reading, so that I can know what to do, when to do, where to do it, and why when the time comes. Cognitive behavioral therapy is having a conversation with someone who will give you positive feedback on what is right and good, and offer you an alternative to something that is negative. Number four, take deep breaths. It is said in scripture that God breathed life into man. He gave man the breath of life. He breathed into man, and man was alive. Take deep breaths. The soul of man travels on your breath to eliminate your anxiety naturally. You have to become aware of your breath and slow it down, because a person suffering from high anxiety, extreme anxiety, hyperventilates. Slow that person down. Get them to breathe deeply. Get control of their breathing. Slow breathing has been shown to decrease activity in the amygdala area of the brain and increases the levels of relaxation throughout the entire body. If you feel panic coming on, or you feel anxious in general, try counting to five on your inhale and repeating that same process as you exhale. Breathe in to a count of five. Breathe out to a count of five. Practice this when you're under strain. Practice this when you're under pressure. Maintain control of your thought processes, and your processes will respond to you. Breathing in a brown paper bag has been shown to be effective in relieving anxiety, as it replenishes the carbon dioxide in the bloodstream, which becomes depleted when we hyperventilate. Number five on my list of eight, relax your muscles. All those who know me, and you know me, of course, have seen me do things to relax my muscles when I'm under tension. There's something I do with my shoulders to get them to relax. There's something I do with my legs to get my leg muscles to relax. There's something I do with my back to get my back muscles to relax. Responsive to muscle tension, the amygdala seems to increase activation when the muscles are tense. They lock up. Thus, the lockup of the muscles, that knot you feel in the middle of your chest that makes you feel like you want to vomit but won't come up, that's tension, which increases the anxiety and the level of fear, because you begin to feel like you're having a heart attack. You can't breathe and you're under pressure. So progressive muscle relaxation techniques are known to reduce the anxiety-inducing effects of the worked of the amygdala portion of the brain. Try sitting in a very comfortable chair, not laying down flat, sitting up with your chest up and your chin back so your chest is open so that the air can move freely. And alternate between tensing and relaxing each muscle group once at a time. Work from your toes and your feet all the way up your body until you reach your scalp and facial muscles. Regularly practicing this muscle relaxation technique can help you calm your amygdala and reduce your overall physical anxiety. Number six, meditation. Meditate. Prayer. Meditation and prayer has shown to reduce the amygdala's activation, consequently reducing your overall anxiety. When it's prayer, you must believe what you're praying for. You must truly desire through your prayer to your Lord and Savior, glory to my Lord the Most High, what you're asking your Lord and Savior to do for you. For prayer without belief is might as well be toilet paper used in the toilet. It is nothing. Believe what you pray for. In your meditation, you consequently reduce your anxiety. In fact, meditation positively affects both the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala. Not only is meditation beneficial for the relief of anxiety, it also improves a variety of other stress-related symptoms like high blood pressure and insomnia. Will help you sleep, and it will improve your overall ability to relax. Now, some of you may ask, why are you saying meditation and prayer at the same time? When one is truly prayerful, you are in meditation. So I'm putting them together so that you can see the beneficial effects. Prayer can last for as long as you want it, as long as you are in communication with your Lord, the Most High. Prayer and meditation. Number seven on my list. Go exercise. You will recall, when you exercise regularly, you are less stressed, you are less excitable, you are less depressed due to the exercise. When panic or anxiety attacks, pacing or exercising can help reduce the severity of the anxiety or the length of the attack. Exercise works to increase the flow of oxygen to the brain, improving overall brain function and improving symptoms of anxiety. Remember that when you panic, your body is in fight mode. Physical exertion is what your body needs and is designed to do in the midst of panic. Also, having a regular exercise routine as a preventative measure can help rid your body of any excess adrenaline in the system. Numerous studies have demonstrated exercise's ability to decrease anxiety and even have relaxing effects for up to 6 hours after a workout. Feeling stressed? Get a workout in. Reduce your stress. Take a walk. Take a jog. Lift some weights. Do something. And last but not least, and quite possibly the most important, get some sleep. Sleep is essential to reducing anxiety and stress. As important as it is to get enough hours of sleep, equally important is the quality of your sleep. Researchers have found that reduced anxiety in the amygdala is associated with getting more REM sleep, meaning the period of time when you sleep when you dream. REM sleep occurs during the late hours of sleep. So if you're tossing and turning throughout the night, there's a good chance you aren't getting the quality of sleep your body needs to remain stressed and anxiety free. Investing in a more comfortable mattress, wearing earplugs at night, establishing a consistent bedtime, having a bedtime ritual, using your bed primarily for sleep, not working or watching TV, and making sure your room is pitch black as well, are all ways to ensure that you get a better night's sleep. Are each of these things that I shared, from my opinion and my research and my work, to prepare myself to tend for one who is under stress and suffering from high anxiety? These tips I found do work to reduce stress and fear, and the cause of your anxiety may be linked to another imbalance in the body. Make sure you listen to your body and make a point to be aware of your thoughts, feelings, and emotions. So, this is Not So Mad Science, and I'm your host, Brother Haram Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. That is my opening explanation for tonight's program. So, to that end, we're going to take a momentary break away. We're going to find a piece from Aretha Franklin that will allow us a few minutes to get prepared to get in to where we left off last week. So here's a little bit of Aretha Franklin. Welcome back, welcome back. This is Not So Mad Science. It's your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Picking up where we left off last week, if we know the cause of something, we can generally prevent the cause from going into effect. For example, the discovery and proof of Ronald Ross that the malaria germ was carried by the mosquito makes it possible to prevent the disease from committing the ravages it once enjoyed at the expense of mankind. Similarly, when one knows the cause of aberration, now I'm going to give the definition of aberration once again so that we can all stay on the same page. Aberration is any deviation or departure from rationality. To include psychoses, neuroses, compulsions and repressions and depressions, anxieties of all kinds and classifications. The word aberration is derived from the Latin word aberre or aberrere, which means to wander. It means basically to error or to err, to make mistakes, or to more specifically, to have fixed ideas which are not true. The word is also used in a scientific sense. It means departure from a straight line. If a line should go from point A to point B, then if it's aberrated, it will go from point A to some other point, to some other point, to some other point, to some other point, before it finally arrives at point B. Taken in the scientific sense, it would also mean the lack of straightness or judgment, or to see things crookedly. As an example, a man sees a horse but thinks he sees an elephant. This man is aberrated. So, while preventative therapy is a large subject infiltrating the fields of industry, agriculture, politics, and other specialized activities, its basic principle is the scientific fact that engrams can be held to minimal content or prevented entirely from large gains in favor of mental health and physical well-being, as well as social adjustment. Now, you've all over these last 3 weeks have been hearing me use this word engram quite a bit. So I'm going to redefine what an engram is for us once again. An engram is any moment of greater or lesser unconsciousness on the part of the analytical mind, the cognitive mind, the thinking mind, which permits the reactive mind, the fear mind, the anxiety mind, the depressed mind, to record the total content of that moment and all its perceptions as pain and suffering. So the engram bank is the storage place in the body where engrams with all of their perceptions are recorded and retained, from which engrams act upon the analytical mind and the body. Okay? The engram is actually a very simple thing. It is the moment when the analytical mind is shut down by physical pain, by usage of drugs, pharmaceutical or otherwise, or some other means, and the reactive bank is open to the receipt of a recording. When that recording has a verbal content to it, it becomes most severely aberrated, crooked. When it contains an antagonism on an emotional level, it becomes destructive. When it is intensely in a pro-survival mode in content, it most certainly becomes capable of thoroughly deranging your life. The engram, among other things, determines fate. The engram that says that man has to fail to survive, or so he has to contrive numerous ways to fail. The engram commands that he can only experience pleasure among the members of another race. So he goes about the process of abandoning his own people to be with somebody else. Engram that says you are no good person. The engram that says you're just like your mother, you're a slut, you're a whore, you're this or that. The engram that says you're a no good father. The engram that says that you're a rapist. The engram that says you're this, that, or otherwise. These are commands that are built into the system. And the command must kill to live. So it goes about killing your cognitive abilities based on heightened emotions due to some stressor or anxiety-inducing painful event. The aberree, the aberrated person, in thousands of ways complicate the lives of others during this process of preventative therapy due to their engramic aberrations. But preventative therapy makes it possible to sort out the aberree who is prone to these failures of cognitive beneficial behavior. In the individual, the prevention of engrams is a very easy matter. Once the source of the aberration and illness is known. So if you're lying to yourself and others, the source of the aberration is not known, therefore you cannot heal. If the source has been known to enter, one can prevent the next step, which is keying in that engram that produces your aberration. So, of course, the final answer in all this is some kind of therapy to clearing you of this process. Preventative therapy addresses this problem in two phases. First, the prevention of the engrams, and second, the prevention of the language or events that key the engram in. So, by taking the key in first, there are two things which we can do to prevent it. We can give you a calm and harmonious atmosphere, which is not restimulative, of what causes your fears and anxieties, thus keying in your anger. The second, you then create the moment by which you can then speak to your aberration, identify it, name it, and attack it. This kills the demon circuit in you and allows you to open that circuit up and see it for what it is. Recognition. No demon wants to be known. The demon must function in the darkness and remain hidden in order to be effective to create sickness in you. Exposing that demon circuit then identifies it, and now it is no longer effective. That doesn't mean you killed it yet. It means now it can no longer hurt you. Then you can go about the steps of removing the demon. The demon circuit which activates your aberrations and your engrams and your anxieties and your behavior. You can kill it and remove it from you forever by creating the environment by which you can no longer be re-stimulated to then attack it head on. Any such engram a person has that contains his mother or his father and another person, that voice is the thing that has an enormous impact and an effect upon you, the individual. And we can take this back to a prenatal stage, and I'll use this as an example. It is not true that emotion gets into a child through the umbilical cord, as people always suppose the moment they hear of prenatals. Emotions come on another, more electrical than physical type of wave. That type of problem for structure. Therefore, anyone who is emotional around a pregnant woman is communicating that emotion straight into the child in the electrical impulses of the mind. A mother's emotion is, in the same manner, so conducted into his or into her or the child's reactive mind. Whether or not the unborn child is unanalytical, meaning thinking, has no bearing on his or her susceptibility to engrams. So if your father was a junkie, a drug user, if your mother was a junkie and a drug user, alcoholic, or whatever, the emotional engrams have been imprinted upon you before you were brought forth into the world. The prenatal engram is just another engram. Only when the child is actually struck or hurt by high blood pressure or orgasms or other sources of injury does he or she become unconscious. When he or she becomes unconscious, he receives all of the perceptions and words in the area of the mother as an engram. And this all happens before you were born. So if your mother was unconscious at some point and being physically abused, verbally abused, these things are being imprinted in the unborn fetus before the fetus has the ability to even think. They are being imprinted. so that when that child becomes conscious, he or she will receive all of the perceptions and the words that were around the mother at the time of her unconsciousness. Analytical power has nothing to do with your engrams. If the child is unanalytical, this does not predispose him to engrams. If the child is unconscious or hurt, it does. The presence or absence of analytical power has nothing to do with whether or not the engrams have been received. You have abused the child before the child is even born. Let's say, for example, attempted abortions, which are very common, and they remarkably lack in success. The mother, every time she injures the child in such a fiendish fashion, is actually penalizing herself. Did you know, brothers and sisters, that morning sickness is entirely engrammatic? It does not have to happen. It is something that has been imprinted on women before they become, get into their childbearing years, by other persons and their words and language about morning sickness due to their own ignorance. The cells of the body know when pregnancy occurs. The reactive mind is acquainted with the fact before the analyzer, the brain, by process of organic sensation, since the endocrine system is altered. Hence, the mother's discovery of pregnancy has little to do with whether or not she was sick before the discovery. There are women who have been pregnant for months at a time and don't experience morning sickness until it is confirmed or they are told they're pregnant. Then all of a sudden, they're having morning sickness. Something has been imprinted on their thoughts. I'm laying this base of engrams for a reason. Preventative therapy. As with any first step, to do this is very easy. Take the time to study yourself. That is the first therapeutic thing that anyone can do who is under stress. Look at yourself. Michael Jackson said it best. Look at the man in the mirror. Have a heart-to-heart conversation with that person in the mirror. And if you don't like what you see when you look in the mirror, talk to that person. Don't fall apart. Talk to that person. Tell that person how much you love them and how much you need them to change their practices and their ways. And then take proactive steps to do what you said in that conversation. That is your first form of therapy, self. Then find someone who loves you enough and cares for you enough to sit and listen to you speak about what you have on your mind. They're not there to give you answers. They're there to listen and not judge you. They're there to listen, not to condemn you. They're there to listen to allow you to speak the words to them that are ultimately directed to yourself. Third thing you do then is seek counsel. Someone that can offer you alternatives to what you have on your mind. This is preventative therapy. You have to understand, brothers and sisters, the mind is a self-protecting mechanism. Short of the use of drugs, like narcosynthesis and shock, hypnotism, or surgery, the mind will do whatever it needs to do to protect itself. There are probably thousands of ways that we can get into trouble with mental healing. And all these ways can be classed in three and four groups. The first and most damaging way is the use of shock or surgery on the brain, destroying brain tissue. The second and most prevalent damaging way used today is drugs, pharmaceutical drugs. The second is some form of hypnosis. And the fourth most damaging way is crossbreeding old ways of therapy with new ways of therapy and really not getting a good blend. It never works. The mind will not permit itself to be seriously overloaded so long as it can retain partial awareness of itself. It can be only overloaded when its awareness is reduced to a point where it cannot evaluate anything. It can be thoroughly upset. There's a process called reverie. Reverie leaves a patient that needs counsel fully aware of everything which is taking place and with full recall of everything which has happened. Types of therapy which do not do this are possible and useful, but they must be approached with the full knowledge that they are not foolproof. Preventative therapy that uses reverie for the majority of its work, and using the reverie, the counselor can possibly get himself in, cannot get into any trouble and mix up the patient at all. That counselor that uses reverie is working with an almost foolproof mechanism as long as the mind retains some awareness. A radio, a clock, an electric motor are far more susceptible to injury in the hand of a workman than the human mind. The mind was built to be as tough as possible. It will be found that it is difficult to get into situations that make it uncomfortable and impossible when the counselor uses reverie to embroil it enough to cause neurosis or insanity. Reverie allows the mind to self-heal and self-protect during the process of preventative therapy and preventative counseling. Reverie. In the U.S. military manual, there's a line about decision and decision making. which says, any plan, no matter how poorly conceived, if boldly executed, is better than inaction. In the preventative therapy that I have been studying to use, any case, no matter how serious, no matter how unskilled the auditor is, it is better open than left closed. It is better to start therapy if it is to be interrupted after a few hours of work than not to start the therapy at all. It is better to contact an engram than to leave an engram uncontacted and unexposed and you not even know it's there. For the open engram will not thereafter possess any power to harm you in a demon circuit because it is open, it is exposed, you know what it is. I'm going to share with you what I found and know to be a scientific fact. This mechanism of preventative therapy using reverie is an ability of the brain which man as a whole did not know you had. It is a process of thought which everyone possesses inherently and which was evidently meant to be used in the overall process of thinking by which some strange oversight we either forgot or didn't even know we had it. And once a person has learned that he or she possesses just this new capability and faculty, he or she is better able to think than you were before. And you can learn this faculty, this ability in 10 minutes. Further, when one approaches an engram with this ability, which, when intensified, is the reverie, some of the engram's abilities and sub-level connections are broken, and the aberrative factors that cause your anxiety and stress no longer have as much force or power, either in the physical or the mental spheres, to harm you ever again. Further, the knowledge that there is a solution to mental ills is a stabilizing factor for everyone. Approaching an engram with the reverie is very far from the same as restimulating the engram exteriorly as it is done in normal life. The engrams are restimulated, the key is in from the outside. Control. But in the process of reverie, you put an engram without keying it in and restimulate it, and you remove its ability, demon. It removes the ability of the demon to do harm, because now you see it for what it is. And then you can go about the process of killing the demon. Do not think that you will not be uncomfortable in this process. That is not true. You will become uncomfortable in reverie because you are looking at yourself. And oftentimes, we don't necessarily like the person that we're looking at. But that is the whole purpose of the reverie. You're fully aware of what you see. You're fully aware of what you say. You're fully aware of what you're doing and where you're at. But someone is there to walk with you so that you don't have to fear and you confront yourself. And I can see by the time that our time is coming to a close, it's almost to the 8 o'clock hour. And I promised my boys that they could close out tonight's program with some special words to a loved one. So, to that end, I am going to share another piece of fine music from KRS-One. Disaster Kit.
Whatever might go down, we're gonna survive that. Hold the shelter, we're gonna find that. When you hear this sound, you know that I'm back. Hey, it's where I put your mind
when
at.
When that disaster hit, don't you get trapped in it. You must always stay prepared with your disaster kit. In the club, you might be drunken, so you may laugh at it. But when you sober up, you know it. Here's what you have to get. Stay prepared, never be fearful or even scared. These natural disasters cannot be compared. So rise and realize you will survive. In the meantime, prepare yourself with these supplies. Get coils of rope and coils of wire. In a waterproof container, put all your fire. Like matches and candles, and don't wear sandals. Get some hard boots and work gloves to handle the situation. Cause when disaster hits the nation, you and your family gonna need your medication. Antibiotics, aspirin, the chronic. Even health foods like vitamins and garlic. Pain relievers, inhalers and breathers. And make sure you got something that can take down a fever. A spray bottle of water with 10% bleach, so you can disinfect the objects you reach. And speaking of bleach, here's what I teach. Don't think that you could drink the water from the beach. You're gonna have to drink that water from your hood and purify your water to make sure it's all good. Put things in order. Put 8 drops of pure unscented liquid bleach into the water. Use only 8 drops for every 1 gallon you work in. You'll need about 5 gallons a person. With no water, things could get lethal. It's dehydration, not starvation, that kills people. So look for the water first. Don't be robbing and looting and stealing and killing. That'll only make things worse. Be smart, plan ahead. Save some cash, a radio, some gas, and some blow-up beds. Keep your disaster kit high on the shelf with your weapons. You might have to defend yourself. Get a flashlight, chemical light sticks, and hold that. A compass, some dry food, maybe a roadmap. Don't forget things like peroxide and Listerine, bandages and antihistamines like Benadryl. So when things get ill, you will survive because you really got skill. You opened your eyes after you gotten your list of supplies. Check your attitude. Know that you're gonna survive. Whatever might go down, we're gonna survive that. Food, clothes, and shelter, we're gonna find that. When you hear this sound, you know that I'm back. Hey, it's where I put your mind at.
Radio Network with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, coming to you live from the city of Detroit. We're now going to turn the mic over to the H Factor, Mr. Saladin Muhammad.
I invite you here today. Well, it's been a while since I've been on here. So we're going to talk about one of the things that are most important to people right now. Aren't doing work and can find a different way to get a job. Video games and watching movies. So, the most popular video game that is going around now is Call of Duty Modern Warfare, Fortnite Battle Royale, and GTA 5. Mostly video games with multiplayer where you can play with other real life players. Let's start with GTA 5, a violent but funny game at the same time. Story mode is pretty hard, takes a while, it's about like a 30-hour game. And in the gaming world, you can talk about how long the game is. If it's a 30-hour game, it's a full-in story game where you have to actually engage and pay attention 20 hours is not a long game, but there are the 50-hour games, which are very rare, which take a long time to finish, like years. If you don't actually just really want to play it after you fall asleep, like you wake up and go right into it playing games. You be you, I be me, everybody can be themselves. And since playing video games kept everybody occupied, YouTube has been blowing up too. New YouTubers can be coming onto YouTube with gaming or anything that's interesting to them that you might think other people might like. If other people might like it, they watch it, give like, subscribe, do whatever they want.
Like and subscribe.
Excuse me for 1 second. I have to do something. Okay, I'm back. Well, in video games, hour-long games are keep you occupied. YouTube gaming has been keeping a lot of people occupied. If you have friends, tell them about your YouTube channel. Ask them if they can give you a like if they like it, and subscribe if they really love it. And if they do, you can ask them to give them friends, because people have more friends. You can have a friend that has another friend. They can tell another friend, and it's like, 1 year, you probably have your first 5,000 to 10,000 subscribers, which makes you about $1,000 a month or to 2 weeks. And when you hit a million, you get more money and more money. That's a job option. Online work. When you're doing online work, since you're working for the same company, you'll be doing a different part of the job, a different part of your job that is just different. You'll figure out, learn how to do it, and, well, movies, you have Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu. If you got cable, use cable, demand. All these new movies are coming out and you can get them on demand. If you do Amazon Prime, you can do movie theaters. You can rent the movie for 2 days. I have been doing that for a while now for movies I haven't seen yet and they've been released. Like the Scooby-Doo movie, they released it on Amazon Prime. And since they released it on Amazon Prime, now you can rent it for $3.99. I only have a few minutes left, so I'm going to get this done quicker. Octavian, I hope you get better. And I just hope that you can get better faster so you don't have to go back to the place. And I love you. Okay, I'm going to hand it over to my dad.
And that was the H Factor, and now it's time for the H Bomb. Lukman Mohammed.
Hi.
Get up.
My name is Lukman. And Power Rangers. And I'm in Jago. And Bakugan and Monkar. So I'm waiting for this year's Monkar to come out. And if you do not make your season 11 on Netflix or put it on Prime, I'm gonna go crazy and destroy things that involve Lego and Jago. But I'm going to 5th grade, Octavian. Octavia. I love you, but I hope you get better, and I don't want to keep going back to the other because it's creepy. Very, very creepy.
And that's the H-bomb. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, with Harold Muhammad here on the Black Pole Radio Network. Once again, and as always, coming to you live from the city of Detroit, Motown. We've come to the close of tonight's program. The H-Factor and the H-bomb stole the airwaves for a few moments. One has a lot to say and the other one wants to be shy. But a promise is a promise. I told them that they could have airtime to say what they wanted to say, how they wanted to say it. That being said, I think we're going to have our fourth and final installment dealing with mental health next week. And God willing, I'll have your attention and I'll have your ears. This is Harold Muhammad signing off. In the immortal words of that great black preacher from the Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York City, the Reverend Dr. Adam Clayton Powell Jr. To you all, I say, oh, by the way, before I close out, I would be remiss and certainly accountable for my actions. This Sunday, or I should say correct me, July 4th, the anniversary date of the Nation of Islam coming to North America, July 4th, 1930, we will have a special public broadcast to be shared with the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. July 4th, from Mas Marion, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan will be giving counsel to the world. Liberty or death in a time of struggle. So, signing off, keep the faith, baby. Keep the faith.